mine to the Saints, looking at Genesis 36, please tonight. My wife diagnosed me with monster this morning when I was complaining, and she only had 3 hours sleep because the children had been up. But I was concerned about my throat, but we'll see. We'll get on the road about 8 o'clock. If the throat hangs in there, if it doesn't, it'll be earlier than that. Now, Genesis 36, tonight, the kind of chapter that perhaps you skip over in your daily reading, I hope you don't. I want to think about the story of Esau tonight. Genesis 36 and verse 1. Now, these are the generations of Esau, or that word, the generations of, can mean many things, and one of the things it can mean is the history of, or the story of, Esau. Who is Edom? Esau took his wives of the daughters of Canaan, Ada, the daughter of Elam the Hittite, and the Holabama, the daughter of Anna, the daughter of Zibeon the Hivite, and Bashemath, Ishmael's daughter, son of Nebaioth, and Ada bare to Esau Eliphaz, and Bashemath bare Reuel, and the Holabama bare Jeush, and Jalam, and Korah. These are the sons of Esau, which were born unto him in the land of Canaan. And Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters and all the persons of his house and his cattle and all his beasts and all his substance which he had got in the land of Canaan, and went into the country from the face of his brother Jacob. For their riches were more than that they might dwell together, and the land wherein they were strangers could not bear them, because of their cattle. Thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. These are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites in Mount Seir. These are the names of Esau's sons: Eliphaz, the son of Ada, the wife of Esau; Reuel, the son of Bashemath, the wife of Esau. And the sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, and Gatam, and Kenaz. And Timnah was concubine to Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bare to Eliphaz Amalek. Now, as you come down the rest of the chapter, we have an expansion of Esau's lineage. We have in verse 19 something of the sons of Esau, and these are their dukes, and we get down something of their leaders and their chieftains. We come down in verse 31 and we find there are kings that reigned in the land of Edom before there reigned any king over the children of Israel, and we have listed some of the kings of Edom. That is Esau. And then we find in the last section of the chapter, from verse 40 down to verse 43, we have something of the names of the leaders of Esau's lineage by the geography of where they live. And the final verse of the chapter, verse 43, the very final clause says, "He is Esau," or "This is Esau, the father of the Edomites." Now, that signpost, we have it three times in chapter 36. Esau is Edom. This is Esau, the father of the Edomites. Esau is Edom. Brings us back to chapter 25. It is a signpost that God has put in place for us to turn back to chapter 25 of Genesis. And what will be to many a very well-known story. The promise in verse 23 of chapter 25 made to Rebekah. The Lord said unto her, "Two nations are in thy womb, two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels, and the one shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger." We know that is Jacob, of course, and Esau. Verse 27 tells us that the boys grew. Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field; Jacob a plain man dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he was innocent, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Jacob sought pottage, and Esau came from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, I pray thee, with the same red pottage, for I am faint." Therefore was his name called Edom. And of course, God's postscript on the entire event is the final clause of verse 34. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Now, we're going to come back to Genesis 36, so you can keep your finger in there. But just one verse in Hebrews 12, because God makes a New Testament statement about Esau that we have to take reference of. If we're going to learn the lessons of Esau and the story of Esau, we need to take cognizance of it. Hebrews chapter 12. And verse 15, God says, looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled, lest there be any fornicator or profane person, as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. For you know how that afterward, when he would have inherited the blessing, he was rejected. For he found no place of repentance, though he sought it carefully with tears. And we give thanks to God for his word tonight. And we come back to Genesis 36. I want to learn something of the story of Esau. This statement, the generations of, 10 times in the book of Genesis. And of all the divisions of Genesis, you might read in commentaries, this is God's division. He divides it like this, 10 times, the generations of, or the story of. Starts off with the story of the heavens and the earth in chapter 2, which tells us straight away that the idea of generations is more than just the people that came from a man. Because the story of the heaven and the earth, interestingly, in chapters 2, 3 and 4, is a story in chapter 2 of how God made the earth for man. It's a man-centered creation in the language of chapter 2. It's very interesting. In the second aspect of creation, man is considered by God in the creation of it all. Then man falls in chapter 3. Then God promises a redeemer in chapter 3. Then man will either come to him or won't come to him by faith in chapter 4. That, brethren, is the story of the heaven and the earth. And that's the way that God uses this language, the story of. And when we come to chapter 36, therefore, we'd be mistaken to think that all God is doing is giving us Esau's children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. He's telling us the story of Esau. And there are spiritual lessons to learn. Now, I want to do this under 7 headings tonight, all beginning with D, for the sake of this meeting. And the first one I want to think about is the disposal of Esau, because that's what chapter 36 in one sense is. It's the disposal of Esau from the record, or the focus of the record of Genesis. What I want to think about as we come to chapter 36 is God is, if you like, putting his final statements for the book of Genesis on the person Esau. He has come and gone in the narrative. But God is going to focus from chapter 37 onwards, interestingly remember, not, you might think it was the story of Joseph, wouldn't you? Chapter 37 to the end, well it's not. What does God call it? It's the story of Jacob. Because chapter 37 to 50 of the book of Genesis is the story of Jacob. Through his son, how Jacob, who of course is Israel, will be saved by his son. How he will be brought to the glory. How all the past were put right and things worked out for God's glory. Well, the story of Jacob is in chapter 37 or the end. But before we get there, God finishes the story of Esau. And just like in chapter 25, the story of Ishmael is given, much shorter, as God puts Ishmael to the one side. Here we have Esau put to the one side. As God focuses, remember, Genesis is not a history book. It does tell history, but that's not the point of the book. It is God's focusing on specific truth for the world to know, and particularly to focus on the messianic line. God is always trying to get us to Christ. So Esau has to go into the sidelines, if you like, because we want to follow the messianic line, and we're going down to Jacob now. Having said that, of course, there are lessons to learn. And as we think about chapter 36, we have to recognise that as though God is disposing for Esau, there is, see the second D for you if you're taking notes, there is a destiny of Esau that is caught up in these verses. And in fact, in chapter 25, we reference in verse 23, we read something of the destiny that God had set for Esau. Remember what he said in the promise to Rebekah. There are two nations in thy womb. Not just two man children, not just two boys. Two nations. Now, of course, if you understand something of the wider truth of the Bible concerning Jacob and Esau, you will know that God speaks and declares in Romans chapter 9 something of his purposes in selecting Jacob, that God has chosen. And he didn't choose the strong man. He didn't choose the first man. He didn't choose the firstborn. He chose Jacob. Sovereign will is at play. God's purposes are being worked out. But I want to say that one of the reasons why chapter 36 of Genesis is here, and of course when you come to a chapter like this, you have to ask the question, why is it here? And why should I not slip over it in my reading and get on to chapter 37 and the exciting story of Joseph, of Jacob. Why should I look at chapter 36? Well, because God is stating and fulfilling his promise. This is really important. Why all these names? Why all these statements that there were kings? Why all these statements of all the dukes? Sounds very grand, doesn't it? The Duke of Edom. It doesn't mean a chieftain, really. But it sounds quite good. Why all these dukes and all these clan leaders? Why going on to a king in Edom before there was ever a king in Israel? We're told in chapter 36. Why is God stating, not just in the short term, but down through the generations, it seems chapter 36 of Genesis goes right up the day of Moses, certainly in some aspects of the leaders that are mentioned of the nation of Edom. Why is this being emphasized? We have a nation called Seir, who lived in Mount Seir, from a man called Seir, who Esau seems to intermingle with, and also but take over. It's not Seir's nation that Esau becomes part of, it's Esau. Esau leads. Esau's genealogy, Esau's sons and grandsons stand at the head of a mighty nation. Why? Because God has said there would be a nation for Esau. And what God says, God means. Now you might think, he came all the way from Aberdeen to tell us that. I'll tell you more on that. But yes, I did. And I want to just say this very simply, brother. We live in a day where the vast majority of professing Christians believe, in one sense, that what God promises, he doesn't really mean. You say, really? Yes. Because most Christians today believe that when God says he has promised Israel a future, and a restoration, and a revival, when he promises a literal thousand-year reign of Christ upon the earth, when he promises Israel will be the head of the nations, when he promises the lion will lie down the lamb, and so on, and so on, and so on, that although he said that, he doesn't really mean that. Now, the Word of God tells us very clearly that it matters to God that his word is kept. One of the wonderful reasons why Genesis 36 is so elaborate and has so many names you can pronounce, neither can I, that's why I stopped in verse 12, is for this reason. God is putting on record, underlining this. I made a promise. I said there would be two nations. And there were two nations. There wasn't just Israel. There was Edom as well. Of course, he made more than those promises. You come to chapter 27 of Genesis. What does he promise? Well, through the blessing that Isaac gave to him in chapter 27 and verse 39. Isaac, his father, answered Esau when he was crying, of course, about the loss of his birthright, which was a bit late. He said, "Behold, thy dwelling shall be the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven from above." So he's promising the fatness of the earth. He's promising geographical expansion. He is promising the enjoyment of the earth. He will have some riches. And he promises in verse 40, "By the sword shall I live and serve thy brother. It shall come to pass, it shall have dominion, they shall break his yoke from off thy neck." Chapter 36 tells us all about that. The fatness of the earth, the geographical expansion of Edom. And we'll think about that perhaps a bit later. God's promises, the destiny of Esau. Now, The third theme in the last of these is the disposition of Esau. The disposition of the man. Because the story of Esau and where Esau ends up all comes back to, and by God is emphatically underlined with this idea that Esau is Edom. Now we have it three times in chapter 36, just in case you miss it. Okay? Esau is Edom. And as God therefore is recording the story of Esau, he wants to get us back to chapter 25 in our thinking, to remember why he's called Edom. Edom meaning red. And immediately you think, well, Edom, that sounds very much like Adam. And you'd be right to think that, because they are very closely linked together. Edom is red. Adam is, of course, the man of the red clay, the red earth. And what we find is that what God is going to tell us about Esau, part of the story of Esau is the disposition of this man, what he is disposed to, what his interests are, where his heart lies. Isaac might have loved him. Clearly he did. He was clearly Isaac's favourite. Must have some good meat, I suppose, by the looks of it. But what is it about the man that God emphasises? Now, chapter 25 is very clear. Now, you know the story well, I suppose. Certainly it's a very straightforward story, and we read some of it tonight. That there is a great difference between Jacob and Esau. Jacob is the man's man, you understand. He's the hunter. And he's the man that is linked with manliness when he comes out all hairy. At the start, wasn't a fight to his mother, I'm sure, but hairy and red. But he's not called Edom because he came out red and hairy. We find that as the story proceeds, God tells the difference between the boys. The boys grew, and the character of the boys came out. And of course, the key moment that is emphasised for us in Genesis 25 is that when Esau comes in from the field, you know, and he tells us that he's dying. Now, men tend to be like that, don't they? Exaggerate beyond all belief. Esau was not dying. He was nowhere near dying. Now, I don't know what kind of red pottage or red stew Jacob had for him. But it says after he'd eaten that, off he went on his way. Any man who's dying, you know, a couple of bowls of red pottage doesn't just, you know, bring you miraculously back to life. He was not dying. This was the overstatement and the elaboration of the man's man. The rugged man. And who just kind of stumbles and states, actually in a bit of a Neanderthal way, he repeats the idea, give me some of that red. And says it twice, the red. Do you know what it is? And the story, of course, goes that as the birthright that he had as the firstborn, which of course in the book of Genesis is linked with spiritual privilege and blessing, he considers that to be of absolutely no importance compared to just some red stuff now. Now, straight away we have some blessing. Here's the disposition of Esau. What matters to Esau is the short term, not the long term. He says that in chapter 25. You know, what use is this to me? I'm going to die anyway. He basically says, I want this now, not that, and all that it means for the future. Esau is the man of the short term. He's also the man of the material. Give me the physical now, not the spiritual then. He doesn't value at all that which is sacred, that which is spiritual, that which is holy. And in fact, that is the statement that is made in Hebrews 12. A profane man. That is, there's nothing holy, nothing sacred. The world would love Esau today. He's a world's man. Give me the material and the physical, that which will satisfy my physical desires now, the spiritual, the eternal, of no interest whatsoever. It's the Esau principle. That is why, of course, he's linked, incidentally, in chapter 12 of Hebrews with fornication. With premarital sexual activity. I want to please the flesh and my physical desires now. And what I want is now, and I'll have it now. The future, the long term, the spiritual, from no interest. A profane rock. Now, that's his disposition. I suppose we could learn very quickly, couldn't we, some lessons for ourselves. We live in that kind of world that demands that our interests are focused on the short term and the physical desires. That what we're taken up with and what our interest is in the physical, in the material. That the eternal and the spiritual doesn't matter, and perhaps we can just stop for a moment. You know, I used to think this was the kind of thing that only young people had to deal with. Then I got a little older, stopped being young anymore. And the decisions of every day and every week that keep a life on the track of the spiritual matters more than the physical and the material, that the eternal matters more than the now. They're not once in a lifetime decisions when you're 16 or you're 18. They're every day, and it's very easy to get off the track. And to find yourself living a lot more like Esau than you ever thought you would. Now God is giving us lessons, remember? This is the story of Esau. Where he ends up. An awful place to be. Standing as the principles that governed a life that took him to the place he ended up as the principles of Edom. Give me that red. The world will encourage that kind of thinking and behaviour all the day long. God says, we seek the spiritual. And of course the best. Jacob, of course, with all his mistakes, and Jacob wasn't perfect. The one thing he had was a desire for the spiritual. He went about it the wrong way, lots of times. But he had a focused desire on the spiritual. Incidentally, it must have been an awful thing to have a firstborn son like he did, who didn't know what he wanted. Reuben. The one thing that marked Jacob didn't mark Reuben. Reuben, the unmal, unstable in all his ways. One day he wants the best thing, and the next day he doesn't. You feel sorry for him. He wants to do what's right, never ends up quite getting there. Jacob wanted the spiritual. With all his failure, Esau wasn't interested. Now, that's the disposition of Esau. Now, that leads us on to the decisions of Esau. Because in chapter 36, we have a reference to two decisions that he makes. Those are marriage decisions and then location decisions. And you might expect this to become exceedingly practical very quickly. Because he's about to decide who's going to marry and where he's going to live. And God tells us in the story of Esau who he marries and where he lives. Firstly, his marriage decisions. You'll notice we are told about his three wives. That'll be a problem in itself. On many fronts. Not least of which their names are a bit difficult to pronounce, but it must have been hard for him. And they seem to go by many names. If you look through the scriptures and compare the references to his wife's names in chapter 26 and in chapter 28 and in chapter 36 of Genesis, I'll leave you to do that tonight in your bed before you go to sleep. But he has three wives. And what is emphasized, notice in verse 2, Esau took his wives of the daughters of Canaan. Now he also takes a wife of Ishmael's daughter, verse 3. But the emphatic statement is that Esau took his wives of the daughters of Canaan. We have Hittites, verse 2, and Hivites, verse 2. Hittite and a Hivite. Chapter 10 of Genesis tells us that Hittites and Hivites were of the land of Canaan, they were Canaanites. Now, very simple. We are told in chapter 24 and verse 3 that Isaac was not to have a wife of the Canaanites. We are told in chapter 28 that Jacob was charged not to take a wife of the Canaanites. A family theme going on here. Don't take a wife of the Canaanites. Esau took two wives of the Canaanites. Took a third wife as well, chapter 28. What he was trying to do, I'm not just too sure. He might have been trying to get his folks back on side again by taking a family member. But he made things worse. A very simple statement, Brian. Here we have a man who is making marriage decisions that will affect his life and the direction of his life. They always do. Wise counsel is required in the matters of the heart and of the making decisions in marriage. I just encourage all in the hall, those that are involved in making such decisions and guiding such decisions, to ensure that the spiritual is preeminent and is the priority. This man was not helped by his wife. It's quite clear from chapter 27 that Rebecca and Isaac were weary. Rebecca weary of her life because of the daughters of Heth, the Canaanites, that Esau married. He brought into the home and into his family disaster, and into his own life disaster, by his decisions in marriage. And part of the story of Esau, quite evidently, is that he married of the Canaanites, and Jacob did. The second decision, of course, is linked with his location. Notice in chapter 36, verse 6, that he took of all his substance and went into the country, at the end of verse 6, from the face of his brother Jacob. For the riches were more than that they might dwell together, and the land wherein they were strangers could not bear them because of their cattle. Thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir. Here we go again. Esau is Edom. What's happening? Well, you'll notice the language of verse 7, that the land couldn't bear them because of their cattle, the riches that they might dwell together. That verse is framed in the same language as the event which has taken place many years before with Abraham and Lot. When God does this, he wants us to take notice. What happened then? Abraham and Lot couldn't dwell together because of their riches and because of their much cattle. The land could not bear them. What happened? One man went down to Sodom, one man went up to Hebron. What a difference of place. What a decision to make. One man down to Sodom, one man up to Hebron. So the spiritual difference could hardly be greater. And that's what's being emphasized here. A decision is being made. Jacob is no saint. But you'll notice what it says in verse 7. It says that they were strangers. The land wherein they were strangers. The word is sojourners. That is, they didn't settle down. This is said of Esau as well. Notice. The land which in they were sojourners. They wandered with their cattle. I mean, it wasn't just two-man tent, of course. It was a moving farm, okay? It's quite a big operation, you understand. But they were sojourners. They had no permanent dwelling. That was the family history. That's what God called them to. Notice the statement of verse 8. Thus Esau dwelt in Mount Seir. Now you see the tent has been taken down. Esau has settled down. The days of sojourning are over. He has settled in Mount Seir. He moves from, if you like, the centre of a land down to the south to Mount Seir, the land of Edom. And he settled down. Now, that word dwell, it's not a simple word, but the first usage of it is of Cain, dwelling in the land of Nod. You get the picture. What's God telling us of the story of Esau? He settled down. Would you expect anything else? The disposition of the man the man who loved the earth and the physical and the material, he settles down here. And he makes himself at home here. You wouldn't expect anything else, would you? Now it's interesting, he'd been connected with Mount Seir before. Jacob knew where to find him in Mount Seir early on in the story. If you go back and look at it twice over, he's linked the land of Seir. But here it seems to be the emphasis that he settled down there. That's what happens, you see. You start to get to know the world and feel a bit comfortable with it, then you just settle down. How are we getting on, Christians? How are we getting on with the whole pilgrim and stranger character? Everything around us mitigates against the character of a pilgrim and a stranger in the world. Are we settling down? Esau went to the town to settle down. Interestingly, we are told in Deuteronomy 2 that God gave the land of Seir to Esau. It says that he drove out the Horites and gave it to Esau as a possession. Deuteronomy 2:12. Joshua 24, verse 4, God says, I gave Esau Mount Seir. You say, well, it's all sounds very spiritual. Why did God give it to him? He promised him the fatness of the earth. He gave him a lot. But all through the book of Genesis, the giving of a land and of territory and of blessing is linked with a man blessing God. God blesses man. Man references the giving of the Almighty. You can scan through chapter 36, keep reading it, and keep reading it. You won't find a mention of it. Esau took the land of Seir, and in his eyes, it was all down to him. Very sad, isn't it? The decisions of Esau. Now, with 10 minutes left, and a lot of notes left, the descendants of Esau. Because, of course, we have the statement, Esau is Edom. And not only that, but the statement that Esau is Edom, and in verse 12, notice we stopped the reading there, that one of Esau's sons, Eliphaz, had wives, but also had a concubine called Timnah, and she bare Eliphaz, Amalek. Edom and Amalek. Now, for anyone who read the Bible a bit, the Old Testament, those are familiar names. Edom and Amalek. Edom, the main tribe. Amalek, a tribal offshoot. Edom and Amalek. Now, you see, the story of Esau doesn't finish in chapter 36. God is summarising the story in chapter 36 to get on to the story of Jacob. But the story of Esau goes right through the Old Testament because Edom and Amalek keep popping back up again. And what is very instructive in the reading of the rest of the Old Testament is to understand that Edom and Amalek came from the man of the flesh, the man of the world, the man who loved the present and the material, not the eternal and the spiritual. Helps you understand Edom and Amalek a lot better. And what God says about them. Now, God says a lot about them. Okay, so I can't summarise in 9 minutes all that God says about them. But I want to just notice that there are two primary features of Edom and two primary features of Amalek. And interestingly, in both of those terms, in those nations of Edom and Amalek, there is one representative man in the rest of the Bible, it seems to me. First of all, we have Edom. And Edom is linked with two things. He's linked with pride, and he's linked with envy. Edom, linked with pride and linked with envy. Let me prove that to you very, very quickly. Just before I do that, remember this. He was the brother of Jacob. What God says, Deuteronomy 23 and verse 7, what God says to his people, he says, thou shalt not abhor an Edomite, for he is thy brother. You'll not abhor an Edomite. He is thy brother. Now, come to the book of Obadiah. I'm ahead of you here because I've got a marker on my Bible in Obadiah. So while you look for it, I'll be there before you. Obadiah, which is one of the less read prophets, is all about Edom. And therefore we get some summary truths about Edom expressed in the judgment of God upon the land of Edom in Obadiah. Verse 2 of Obadiah, you'll see verse 1, thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom. Verse 2, behold, I have made thee small among the heathen, thou art greatly despised. The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee. Thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, that saith in his heart, who shall bring me down to the ground? Look at verse 12. But thou shouldest not have looked in the day of thy brother, and the day became a stranger, neither shouldest thou have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction, neither shouldest thou have spoken proudly in the day of distress. Notice the emphasis, the pride of thine heart, speaking proudly. Thou that dwellest, verse 3, in the clefts of the rock. You see, Edom, as a land, that bit south, I was going to say it was, it still is, because the doctrine doesn't change that much. Down the south of Israel there, into the land of Edom, what is Jordan today, is a very rocky mountainous area, Mount Seir. There are areas that are almost, well, they're almost unable to be attacked because they're so impregnable. Particularly the city of Petra, which you can Google when you go home, which was one of the capitals or one of the chief cities of Edom, of Seir. Virtually impregnable. And Edom sat up on his hills and proudly sat there in the fatness of the earth and looked down at everybody. Very basic principle. You know, it says that Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. That which flows from Esau meets with God's utter condemnation throughout the Old Testament. Here's one feature, pride. And Christian, it can very easily get into this pride. Despite Edom having been put off to the side, Esau having been sidelined, Jacob, the lineage of choice, what does God say? Thou shalt not abhor an Edomite. You have not to be proud. They didn't listen, of course. And Israel became proud in their position and their place. But what sprung from Esau? Marked by pride. Obadiah says, God says, I will bring you down. Secondly, Ezekiel 35. I've been in Ezekiel the last couple of months. What a fascinating book. It is very hard to teach, which is why I didn't get it to teamwork. But wonderful book. Ezekiel 35 and verse 11. I can't introduce the whole of the book of Ezekiel here now, but chapter 35 is very climactic. You know, God has already dealt with all of the nations that he's going to deal with in the book of Ezekiel and condemning them and judging them for their attitude to Israel. He's gone right through a array of nations. And then he stops, promises blessing to Israel, and he comes back to Edom and gives them another go in chapter 35, right? So you go, God's really serious about Edom. And there is something about the fact, this by the way is I think the key to it all, there is something about the fact that he is the brother of Israel, of Jacob, and how he treats Israel despite being his brother, that God utterly abhors. And he comes back in chapter 35 and look at verse 11. He says, therefore, as I live, saith the Lord God, I will even do according to thine anger and according to thine envy, which thou hast used out of thy hatred against them. And I will make myself known among them when I have judged thee. There is constant opposition of Edom against Israel all the way through. From the time they came out, of all the nations, in Numbers 14, what does Moses say? He sends that message to the Edomites. And it's a very kind and a very pleading letter, if you like, asking for safe passage through the land of Edom. And he tells them about the slavery they had in Egypt. And of all the people who should have understood, it's their brother, Edom. He said, thou shalt not pass. I will come out against thee. And they came out against them. Hatred based upon envy. An awful thing. Pride and envy. Now you can go through all of the references to Edom throughout the scriptures and you'll come up with that constant theme. Pride and envy. Pride and envy. They are all told together in one man in the New Testament. We're not actually told in the New Testament that he was from Edom, but we know he was. Herod the Great. The only Edomite that sat on the throne, if you like, of Israel. He was the man in charge. The Romans called him the King of the Jews. Tracy's characteristics, pride and envy. Now, I have no time for Amalek really, but let me give you a few minutes. If Edom is marked by pride and envy, Amalek is marked by no mercy and no fear of God. In fact, God says that in chapter 25 of Deuteronomy. He says, verse 17, remember what Amalek did unto thee by the way when you were come forth out of Egypt, how he met thee by the way and smote thee of the hindmost of thee, even all that were feeble behind thee, when thou wast faint and weary. What's he saying? He'd no mercy. He came out, when they came out of Egypt, Amalek came in and didn't meet them head on, went to the back, to the weak and the feeble, and pulled them down. What a merciless crew. God says, remember it, as I do. He carries on. He says, Amalek feared not God, Jeremiah 25:18. Therefore it shall be, when the Lord hath given thee rest from all thine enemies round about in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for inheritance to possess it, thou shalt blot out of the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Thou shalt not forget it. No mercy and no fear of God. Follow the Amalekites through your Bible and see that that theme is fulfilled. Who's the man that stands as representative of them all? A man called Haman, who was an Agagite. And if you remember, it's a what a name, Haman the Agagite. But of course, Agag was the king of Amalek. Solomon has a lot, has a lot to answer for. Seemed to have let the royal house go. And Agag's son, and great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson, Haman, mercilessly and with no fear of God, wanted to wipe every Jew off the face of the earth. That's Amalek. That comes from the flesh. That comes from the man who wants the world and not God. Pride, envy, no mercy, no fear of God. Now, I don't have time for my last 2D, but I'll give it anyway very quickly. The demise of Esau. You look at the book of Malachi, first few verses, and you'll find this. That Edom, that is Esau, will be wiped out completely. We are told in Malachi that they will go. That he will bring them down. That God will deal with them. He will have indignation against them forever. Ezekiel 35, we didn't read the verse, but verse 14 says this. When the whole earth rejoices, I will make thee desolate. When the whole earth rejoices, I believe that's a millennial term. The whole world will rejoice, and some of those old nations that were against Israel will be resurrected and given a place. You know, isn't that amazing? Isn't it remarkable? Egypt will be the millennium. So will Assyria. You can believe it, would you? Your God is a merciful God. And he will bring a nation, he will bring a national representative from Egypt and Assyria into the millennium. I don't think you're going to Edom. That verse will be fulfilled. When the whole earth rejoices, I will make thee desolate. Same with Amalek. The prophetic words of Balaam. Numbers 24. Balaam took up this parable of Amalek. Amalek was the first of the nations. That is the first to oppress Egypt, Israel when they came out of Egypt. But his latter end shall be that he shall perish forever. God will deal with a man of the flesh. He will deal with a man who wants nothing of him and wants this world. My final day is the disaster. The disaster of Esau. To be born into that family. To be born with the firstborn blessing, I suppose, in view, if you like. Certainly born into a place of privilege. And to end up there. May the Lord help us and preserve us from living like fornicator, the profane man, Esau. Help us all to have our eyes set on that which is spiritual and eternal. And that which lasts and that which is worth. And may the features of pride and envy and no mercy and no fear of God be far from us as we follow an obligate of different path.